Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. I am just inundated with emails complimenting me on my rant yesterday in reference to garlic-dipped sexual playthings. I don't want to say anything more at this point. Tried to explain that to Nikki this morning. I've never gotten such good feedback. About what? I was suggesting that if David Koch told Scott Walker to wave garlic-dipped dildos at union workers, they'd melt.
Freedom dildos.
Freedom dildos. And Nikki literally looked at me and just goes, I don't have time for this. Today on the program, we will be running an interview I did with Chris Hedges last week, towards the end of the week. It's a great interview. It's 30 minutes long. We'll be running it shortly. So a wonderful show for you today. Let's start off just catching you up. What's going on in Libya? Apparently, Libyan warplanes now have bombed an oil refinery and in the port town of Marsa El Brega on Wednesday. They are again about 7-8 hours ahead of us. It's now an air attack. We just watched an Air Force jet from Libyan Air Force fly over Brega and drop at least one bomb. This is from Al Jazeera's Tony Britley. Libya seems to be devolving into a civil war, and this is a worry becoming an international worry. Obviously, this has been an international issue for quite some time, but we are seeing the beginning movements, perhaps, of a contemplation of military intervention by, if not unilaterally by the United States, by perhaps NATO or the UN. U.S. sent warships to the region as part of a Western effort to pile more pressure on Gaddafi to stop his violent crackdown and step aside. The destroyer USS Barry moved through the Suez Canal on Monday and into the Mediterranean Sea. Two amphibious assault ships, the U.S. Kearsarge, which can carry 2,000 Marines, and the USS Ponce passed through the canal on Wednesday. The White House said the ships were being deployed in preparation for possible humanitarian efforts, but stressed it was not taking any options off the table. This follows a story from Press TV on Monday, saying one option on the table is using NATO air power to enforce a no-fly zone over Libya. That measure, however, would require a UN approval. The UN just took Libya off, I think, all of its committees. And so this could presage a move by the UN to enforce a no-fly zone. If you've got Gaddafi using his own air force to fire upon his own people, I think we're looking at the very least, a potential situation to create a no-fly zone. Let's listen to this report from Al Jazeera today.
A rebel army prepares for war. At locations across Benghazi, civilians gather for boot camp. Learning how to move as a battalion and fire weapons in preparation to march on Libya's capital.
These people are coming here to help our country become free, and they want to defend our land. They will learn how to fight and use weapons to go and liberate Tripoli.
The leaders of these ragtag units springing up across eastern Libya say they already have 5,000 volunteers. Learning to fire military hardware is just part of the job. Ensuring the stockpiles left by Colonel Gaddafi's forces are even working can be a bigger challenge. Many retired soldiers oversee the difficult preparations, teacher and pupil united by a common dream.
All people here are one heart and they believe in one Libya. So there is no way in going back. We're going to finish this job.
And so we shall see. Remember, Libya, very tribal, and the support from Gaddafi coming from his tribe, forces loyal to Gaddafi are trying to maintain hold and regain hold of small towns that surround Tripoli, which, of course, is the base of his power. So we'll keep you updated on that. Another dispatch from Wisconsin. Dave Dayan was on the program on Monday discussing this, and as his thoughts coalesced, he has a great piece on Fire Dog Lake that I recommend you check out. I'll read you some of it. He reports that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which endorsed Scott Walker on its editorial pages in its election just 5 short months ago, now routinely criticizes him, and today came out with an editorial explicitly against his so-called budget repair bill. Walker, meanwhile, is ramping out-of-state funded TV ads, which, according to Dayan, shows his nervousness over whether his allies, the Senate Republicans, will waver and eventually lack the numbers to pass the bill. And, of course, Dayan notes that Charles Koch wrote a piece in the op-ed the other day. In the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, decrying crony capitalism and the influence of money on our politics. What do we know how much money he spent? It was $40 million on outside groups, another several million on direct contributions. That doesn't even begin to enumerate the millions of dollars he spent on things like Cato and Heritage, and you know how much money has been laundered through there. If he hasn't spent $500 million over the past 10 years, I'd be shocked. And, of course, just the rampant cronyism. And how come this guy gets to put an op-ed on the paper? But be that as it may, it's probably less helpful for Walker. Fall in the wake of that phone call. The only thing I can say that struck me as odd is the op-ed piece was in the Wall Street Journal, correct? Wall Street Journal? Yeah. On page 32 of the Wall Street Journal today, you can find a huge ad for Freedom Dildos. I don't know if that's in any way related. So David Dayan also outlines the legal claims against the bill. Milwaukee City Attorney came out today, meaning yesterday, declared that the budget repair bill is unconstitutional. Governor Scott Walker's state budget repair bill would be unconstitutional because it would violate the constitutional home rule that protects cities and villages from interference in local pensions by the state. It's according to a legal opinion issued by the Milwaukee City Attorney General Grant Langley. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, who lost to Walker, you'll remember, in the gubernatorial race, has already asked Walker to seek a legal opinion from State Attorney General on the topic. In terms of home rule, AFSCME has filed an unfair labor practice against Walker for refusing to negotiate while under a collective bargaining agreement. Dan reports there's still lingering sense that the assembly vote was illegal. As he told us on Monday, there is a belief among assembly members, Democratic assembly members, and there have been rumors. Remember, there's two houses, of course, in the Wisconsin state legislature. There's the assembly, more akin to a Congress, and the Senate, more akin to, a Senate, less representatives, larger districts. There's still a lingering sense that the assembly vote was illegal, Democrats are still looking at all footage of the vote to see if their suspicions are correct that Republicans leaned over and voted by electronic device in place of their missing colleagues. Remember, they called this vote so quickly that I think Republicans couldn't even get back to the chamber. They wanted to end it so quickly that Republicans just sort of, you know, did a favor and voted for their buddy. What are you going to do? There are legal claims against Walker. The phone call from David Koch features a number of statements from the governor that could violate ethics, labor, and election laus. This according to Peg Lautenschlager. Welcome to Wisconsin, huh? The state's former Democratic Attorney General. The question of, we thought about that as to why, you know, Walker referring to the planted thugs. There's an admission Walker's trying to break public employee unions like Reagan broke PATCO. There are campaign finance questions. And lastly, there is the threat of a looming general strike. Capital Times picks up on the fact that South Central Wisconsin Labor Federation has endorsed the notion of a general strike. The Federation has no authority to call a strike, but after March 13th, state public employee unions will be operating without a contract. At that point, all bets are off. When they have a contract, they are, I believe, are prohibited from striking. At least as a as an entire union. And workers throughout Madison, though barred by Taft-Hartley requirements from joining strikes, may do so anyway. And then there's a state Supreme Court race. On April 5th, there's a race for state Supreme Court seat between incumbent Republican David Prosser and Democrat Joanne Kloppenburg. You ain't kidding. Wisconsin. Supreme Court races in Wisconsin are actual elections, according to Dayan. And John Nichols, right, nation writer, also a writer for a Madison paper. This will be a national-level battle, a proxy presidential race, said Nichols, who thinks $10 million will be spent on it between both sides. That's a lot of cheese, folks. Prosser said publicly that he would coordinate his rulings in alliance with the Republican ideology. He's part of a 4-3 Republican advantage on the state Supreme Court. This would shift the balance of power there and provide a major setback for Walker and the Republicans if a Democrat was to beat this incumbent. Legislative seats, the same day as that April 5th special election, there are primaries for 3 state assembly races vacated by 3 Republicans who joined Walker's cabinet. At least 2 of the 3 are seen as strong Republican seats, but progressives in Wisconsin plan to contest all 3. Recalls. There will absolutely be recall elections for many of the Republican 8 state senators who can be recalled immediately. The organizing for this has already begun. A Democratic strategist in the state found the Republican 8 vulnerable to recall because of heightened passions around the issue. This, of course, is happening against Democrats, too. A group from Utah has begun that process. Is Utah must be a town in Wisconsin. What? Oh, it's not? Interesting. And then there's the possible recall of Governor Walker, which would not begin until January 2012. Dayan finishes by writing, perhaps more remarkable than the Wisconsin battle is the one happening in Indiana. State House Democrats walked out there in a protest of a bill that would have crushed private employee unions. The Republicans pulled back on that, but Democrats remained out of the district and vowed to stay put until an education bill that would set up a voucher system was scotched. Ultimately, that's how this new American progressive movement will move forward. The activists and the politicians, the protesters and the reformers, the signature gatherers and the people fighting in the streets, the unions and the college students, all must unite on a series of goals dedicated to the rights of the worker to have a good job and a good house and a reasonable way of life for themselves. People power, basic fundamental rights and justice. These are the tenets of the movement. Quote, the question shall arise in your day, which shall rule, wealth or man, said Edwin Ryan, the Chief Justice of Wisconsin's Supreme Court, in an address to the law school in Madison in 1873. Quote, which shall lead, money or intellect? Who shall fill public stations, educated and patriotic freemen or the feudal serfs of corporate capital? Dayan concludes that the spirit of that has not yet been extinguished in America. I hope he is right. Also out of Wisconsin, Scott Luders reports that Walker, in his address yesterday, his budget address, said he would, quote, eliminate the capital gains tax for investors in Wisconsin companies, include tax relief for employers who hire more people to work in our state, provide real tax relief for homeowners across the state by implementing property tax reform that locks in property tax levies at the local level. And Luder makes the point, aside from the fact that you're crying about a budget deficit and your plan is to reduce revenues. Remember, two-thirds of corporations in Wisconsin already don't pay taxes.
Well, if we reduce taxes, there'll be more business because if we have 5/6 of corporations not paying taxes, then we'll get taxes from the...
Luder makes the point that it does sound, though, the government may have dropped another bomb and announced his intention to end the ability of local governments in Wisconsin to raise property taxes to meet the needs in their communities. With the governor saying he plans to cut state spending to local government by just over $1.25 billion, this might be flexibility the local governments might want to retain. And finally, a judge orders the state capitol open to the general public in defiance of Scott Walker's attempts to close the Capitol to normal, average Wisconsinites. David Koch, however, if he's shaking his freedom dildos, can march right in. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, my interview with Chris Hedges. I think you'll enjoy it. Hear that sound, folks? That's the sound of crickets, and that's the way that we show silence in the radio business. And that's what you'll hear if we don't get enough members to keep this show alive. So become a member today at majority.fm. You'll be supporting the show, you'll get 50 minutes of extra content every day, plus you'll get some swag and a warm, fuzzy feeling inside with no crickets. So on the phone, I have with me Chris Hedges. He, of course, is the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and his latest, Death of the Liberal Class, must reads. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this, particularly in light of everything that's happening in Wisconsin to a certain extent. Tell me what, let's talk about this idea that the liberal class is dead in this country. What is the liberal class?
The liberal class is traditionally defined by roughly six pillars, six institutions within a democracy. And that would be public education, in particular public universities, labor, culture, liberal religious institutions, the press, and finally the Democratic Party. And when these institutions don't function to promote traditional liberal values, which is a concern with the rights and needs of citizens outside the narrow power elite, democratic states tend to break down. This was an obsession with Dostoevsky, the breakdown of the liberal class in novels like Demons or Notes from Underground. Essentially what happens is you shut off that capacity for incremental or piecemeal reform. You close that safety valve that makes it possible through formal mechanisms of power to redress the grievances of working men and women and even your middle class. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing these institutions no longer functioning. We're seeing self-identified liberals, people like Clinton or Obama, who mouth the language and the words, the vocabulary of traditional liberalism, carry out policies that essentially make war against the common citizen on behalf of the power elite, and in particular Wall Street.
So, in the way that you describe the liberal class, it is in some respects almost like in some ways it's a co-optation of the desire of the masses to have some form of social and economic justice.
Yeah, because Conrad Black in his biography of Roosevelt said Roosevelt's greatest achievement through the New Deal was that he saved capitalism. And that's right. Capitalism broke down. You had radical and populist movements that carried sit-down strikes and everything else, and you had a responsive liberal class, figures like Roosevelt or his vice president, Henry Wallace, who pushed through the New Deal. That's a perfect example of how liberals work, and yet at the same time they're used to discredit radical movements because they won't critique the structures and assumptions of the society at large. They won't critique the virtues of those within the power elite. So they serve a kind of dual function. The figure that liberals hates most in American society is not Glenn Beck. It's Noam Chomsky, because he calls them out on their collaboration with the power elite. And traditionally, the power elite has been astute enough to realize the vital role that liberal institutions play. Now, with the rise of the corporate state, we've seen them decimate those institutions without grasping that they are a fundamental part for the maintenance of traditional systems of power.
Has the corporatocracy, has the corporate mentality, has that not been long aware of that dynamic where liberalism in some ways is a force to sort of co-opt and to placate and to partially address some of those issues?
Well, I think traditionally they were aware of that. But with the rise of corporate capitalism and globalization, you have huge corporate entities that no longer have any loyalty to the nation state, so they don't care. They're quite happy to cannibalize the country, to hollow the country out from the inside in the name of corporate profit, because they don't belong to us anymore. And so they don't, in essence, need the liberal class. They are reconfiguring not only American society, but global society, into a kind of neo-feudalism, where you have an elite, a managerial class, and then essentially a kind of permanent underclass, which is two-thirds or plus of the rest of us. And if you look at the statistics on American incomes, on American poverty, that's already very far advanced.
It's interesting because I've seen, in addition to seeing sort of descriptions and the calling out of the existence of an international plutocracy coming from very different quarters, and there were some writers who drew a direct line to that plutocracy from what was happening in Egypt, where you had Hosni Mubarak's son was a guy who would go to Davos. He was a guy who was involved in investment banking and certainly had adopted that philosophy. And simultaneously, you had labor leaders from Tahrir Square who were sending messages to labor leaders in Wisconsin. Tell me when the beginning of this sort of decoupling really, really first started happening. Because it seems to me there was a movement in this country on the right that may have overtaken sort of the calmer, more saner voices of corporatism. Did that happen in conjunction or just coincidentally to a rise in this sort of neoliberal globalist ideology, I guess?
Well, I think what, as Marx understood, unregulated, unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force. I think that the corporate elite were taken over by lunatics. I think they always were lunatics. It's more that all controls were lifted. This has been a long process. It began, in my book, go all the way back to World War I and the rise of the Committee for Public Information and the first system of modern mass propaganda and the kind of permanent mentality of permanent war, which was used quite effectively not only to break radical movements during World War I under the Wilson administration, but immediately after to go after the sort of those who were soft on communism. And so we decimated our intellectual class. We decimated our activist class. We decimated those, the best among us. Thousands and thousands of people became pariahs, including I.F. Stone, probably our greatest independent or investigative journalist, who couldn't even get a job at The Nation magazine after he refused to take Truman's loyalty oath. And so with the destruction of those radical movements and with the internal purges that were carried out within liberal institutions like universities, where thousands of professors as well as high school teachers lost their jobs in the Red Scare, labor unions that were taken over by right-wing Neanderthals like Meany and Lane Kirkland, who severed themselves from the left, virulently anti-communist, supporting Nixon's war in Indochina. We weakened ourselves to such an extent that once the decoupling began, most pronounced under the Reagan administration, but once we began to lift all of these constraints on corporations, we had no way to fight back. And that's what's happened. We've undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, a corporate coup d'etat, and they've won, and we've lost.
In the past, I mean, I want to get to that, obviously, because that's I'm not sure that I frankly disagree with that analysis at all. But what is it about the liberal mentality that has purged itself in some ways? What is it about the liberal mentality that makes someone like Noam Chomsky a greater villain, has more cooties, if it were, as opposed to like a Glenn Beck?
Because the liberal class posits itself as the moral conscience of the nation. That's what figures like Thomas Friedman attempt to do. And Chomsky exposes to what extent they collaborate with the power elite itself. All of these people, these so-called liberals, were cheerleaders for the war into Iraq. And then when the war goes sour, the way they critique it is to say, well, we weren't prepared for the virulence of the insurrection, we didn't have enough troops for the occupation, whatever their arguments are. But they don't critique the actual motives of people like Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and George Bush and Rumsfeld and Pearl and all the others who pushed us into the war. That's a line they don't cross. You can see what happens when you cross that line. If you look at the South African jurist Richard Goldstone's report on the 22-day Israeli assault in Gaza, which he condemned as a war crime, he crossed a line. He became a pariah. He got pushed out. And these lines, having worked for 15 years within the New York Times, they're not written on the side of a wall or something or handed out in a booklet, but you know what they are, and you know the consequences of crossing them. And once you cross them, you are pushed out of the liberal establishment itself. Reward for that is that liberals, and I would argue even today, those figures who constitute the liberal class have a kind of economic well-being that the working class has lost. And that is part of their complicity of silence. A full professor at Princeton, where I live, makes $180,000 a year. Most of these major labor union leaders are pulling down obscene salaries and hundreds of thousands of dollars while they rank and file or struggling on $50,000-$60,000 a year. So they've been bought off in essence, and for that reason they become very ineffectual.
You know, it's interesting because just recently there were revelations that came from Anonymous, the loose confederation of hacktivists who broke into a military contractor, sort of a cyber spying organization, HB Gary, which had been contracted by the Chamber of Commerce, among other corporations, to spy on liberal journalists as a way of undermining WikiLeaks. And there is a now pretty famous at least in my mind, a PowerPoint slide representing Glenn Greenwald as one of the writers. And in the bullet points, it suggests that we can influence and diminish the liberal commentators' support for WikiLeaks by threatening them in some way or undermining them professionally, and more often than not, when faced with choosing between a cause and their professional advancement, they will choose the professional advancement. And this is a fundamental problem in liberalism, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Because, for instance, I covered the Middle East for 7 years. I'm very outspoken about the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians. Nobody I covered the Middle East with in private argues with me, but they recognize to get up and do that in public is career suicide. So it's careerism, and I think a lot of the people who signed onto the bandwagon for the support of the invasion of Iraq did so because they knew it was good for their career. They, in fact, may not, you know, their support for it may have been rather tepid. Most of them didn't know anything about the Middle East, but they knew that to get up and defy the Bush administration in that moment was a career killer. I speak from personal experience. And that's right. I think careerism is actually a huge element of it.
And so we have these forces that have conspired in different ways to essentially to kill the liberal class and to make it a, to the extent that it exists, completely ineffectual and one which has lost this battle in terms of having any type of influence in regulating, I guess, the harshness of our society. So what does something like, where does what's happening in Wisconsin fit into this? This seeming somewhat of a labor uprising.
Well, labor's destroyed. The last readout of labor in this country are the public service unions. I'm sitting here in the state of New Jersey watching Chris Christie work pretty hard to destroy the teachers union. So it isn't going to bring back labor. And I think that in many ways, in terms of the court of public opinion, the ruling class or the oligarchic class has played a very clever game, and that they've said to non-unionized working and middle class, look, you know, you guys don't have benefits, you don't have health insurance, you don't have retirement plans. Why are you spending your tax dollars, giving it to public sector workers who don't have what you have? And I think it resonates. Unfortunately, it's the wrong question. It's why doesn't the middle class and the working class have those kinds of benefits? But the society has become so distorted, and the amplification of these kinds of arguments, which are put forth by the corporate elite, are so widely disseminated. You know, any kind of radical or critical analysis is locked out of the mainstream discourse. I'm heartened, and I think it's great, but I don't know that it's going to effectively halt the steady assault of the corporate state. And by assault, I mean all of those programs like Social Security and what they call entitlement programs that these people are gunning for. I mean, the tragedy is that the victims are being made to pay the price for the malfeasance of the Wall Street speculating class, that they're the ones who are responsible for the economic collapse, the loss of some $40 trillion in worldwide wealth. They carried out clearly fraudulent activity. Not one of them has gone to jail or is in prison. In fact, they've just sucked up billions of dollars of taxpayer money to play these games of casino capitalism again. And it's all being taken out on the hide of working men and women who had nothing to do with the collapse at all. And I don't see forces at this point strong enough to block or to reverse this kind of abuse on the part of CEOs that are making $900,000 an hour.
So we had the situation where the our society's safety valve for reform, the liberal class, is now, in your estimation, more or less defunct. Is there a precedent for something like this? I mean, what is there any history lesson as to what can teach us as to what happens next? Has there really ever been a time where you have an international plutocracy?
Well, I think the history lesson is that you can go back to the 1930s, and some nation states swung towards fascism and some nation states swung towards a benign kind of socialism, which is what the New Deal was. We were fortunate in that we had powerful radical movements and a responsive liberal class. Take that equation away, and we're no different from anyone else. I covered the breakdown of Yugoslavia. I know what happens in moments when you have a dysfunctional liberal class and severe economic turmoil, including a currency collapse in Yugoslavia. It vomits up figures like Slobodan Milosevic in the same way that Weimar vomited up people like Hitler, or the breakdown of Tsarist Russia opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks. We're not immune to those forces. And instead of confronting the weaknesses within our financial system, a system that is built exclusively on selling debt, on borrowing, to the tune of about $2 billion a day, we're trying to borrow our way back to a bubble economy, which you don't have to take economics 101 to figure out over the long term is not sustainable. It isn't going to work. And the longer we refuse to confront the fact that we can no longer afford to maintain both a level of consumption and an empire that we have in the past, the sooner we face that fact, the better it will be. The longer we delay it, the longer we refuse to confront it, the more we continue to expand empire and divert resources towards, in essence, a criminal class on Wall Street, the more civil unrest we'll see, the more draconian measures of control we'll see, and the closer we will come to mirroring the kind of collapse that I covered in places like Yugoslavia.
And so we have a two-part problem. One is that with a liberal class that has not been performing its function of functioning as that safety valve, we also have a less of an opportunity to come out the other side of the product of the lack of a safety valve in a way that it will be not ugly, I guess, that will not be fascistic in a way.
I think that's what we're flirting with. Now, you know, we're sitting here as we speak trying to monetize our debt to the tune of $600 billion, which is just a fancy way of saying they're printing $600 billion of money, the Fed. We can get away with it because we are the reserve currency. But should China and the oil-rich nations walk away from the dollar? Should our debt just become unattractive? And you've seen it now. State debt, state bonds have gone way up. People don't want to buy, don't trust state government. They think that they're ripe for default. That has not happened on a federal level, but it could, unless there's serious structural reform. So if we don't begin to face the reality we're in, then we are playing, I think, a game that potentially includes that final straw, which is currency collapse. Once currencies are upended, and I've lived through three currency collapses, Nicaragua, Argentina, and Yugoslavia, the moral order is just turned upside down. Everything is out the door.
Because all of
the people who were industrious and honest and worked hard for 40 years and have pensions and put away money every month for their retirement or for college or whatever, they're wiped out instantly.
I mean, you know, I agree with you in terms of that scenario, but I just think that the scenario of a currency collapse in this country is far more remote possibility, because you know, the Chinese may want to have a different world currency, but unfortunately for them, and there isn't one. And at the end of the day, we have a our currency has a fundamentally different relationship to the rest of the world.
But you just have had trade deals signed between Russia and China where they're trading ruble for renminbi. I mean, you are seeing cracks in that. And you may be right. I'm not arguing. I'm not an economist. It's clearly, you know, we are not confronting the structural weaknesses within our system at all. We're just pretending they're not there. And the consequences of that are not good. How catastrophic they are, I can't tell you. It has so many factors that lie beyond our control.
What happens in the scenario where the dollar doesn't, where our currency does not essentially become worthless? I mean, what happens in the scenario where we go on a certain way where 10% unemployment becomes the new normal, which apparently, you know, I mean, to watch the news now, to hear anybody talk, nobody talks about jobs anymore. And it's because the people who are out of work are so outside of the media stream in some way that we'd never hear their complaints. And so what if we were to go on like this, where we go from this bubble to the next bubble where more money is extracted from our system to pay? I mean, what if we never have that dollar crash?
Eventually we're going to be servicing a debt of $12.8 trillion, right, which is if we service the debt by borrowing. So that means we're going to have to borrow about $96 billion a week. Maybe people want to keep buying our debt forever, although I'd expect it's going to become harder and harder to sell it. We'll just spend all our money to pay for debt, I guess.
Right. So we're basically looking at austerity. Let me ask you this. Do you think that the American public, faced with austerity, I mean, let's say we do get some cuts in Social Security, although my sense is if they do impose these cuts, they're going to do them down the road, and it's really just a way to not pay back that money that, you know, because 17%, 18%, a far greater amount of our debt than is held by China is actually held by the Social Security Trust. Something like 17, 18, 20% of our debt is actually held by the Social Security Trust. And it's a far greater amount than is held by China. Do you think the American public has the ability to make the connection between governmental policy and their loss of a job or their inability to get health care? Or has Americans become so severed in the concept that what our government does affects them that they're always going to blame the wrong things?
Well, they're blaming government, which is already blaming the wrong thing. Government serves, at this point, the interests of Wall Street. And you watched this split within the Tea Party between the sort of Ron Paul libertarians, whose target was Wall Street and corporations, and people like Dick Armory and the Koch brothers and others who deflected the attention towards government itself. And I think they've sort of won. I'm not sure that the response on the part of many of these people who have been betrayed is a particularly rational response. If you look at the agenda of the Tea Party, for instance, they talk about government as part of the problem, and yet nobody wants to destroy Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment benefits, and nobody wants to touch the military, as if the military is not part of government. Military consuming, of course, half of all discretionary spending. So these movements fulfill an emotional need, and they provide very weak and easily identifiable scapegoats to vent your fury upon. Muslims, undocumented workers, liberals, which is what always happens when societies disintegrate. In Yugoslavia, you saw these figures like Milosevic get up and blame everything on the Muslims or on the Croats or the ethnic Albanians, and it worked. And it's worked in other disintegrating societies as well. So that's what's frightening about sort of the rise of this lunatic fringe within the Republican Party and our political establishment, is that it is, like many of these movements, utterly irrational. You had 50 new members of the House coming in saying global warming doesn't exist.
We're going to wrap this up, but is there anything that gives you any type of hope, or is there something that you think that we could at least do to avert this type of, I don't know if it's a dystopian future or just a really slow...
environmentally, it's dystopia if we don't begin to radically change how our relationship with the ecosystem. What gives me hope are all acts of resistance. And when you engage in those acts, as I did in December with 131 vets, mostly vets from Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam getting arrested in the White House, it was very moving. I mean, it was snowing in Lafayette Park, December 16th. Someone played taps on a harmonica. They folded the flag from some young man who had just been killed in Afghanistan. Everybody walked in silence to the beat of a drum through the snowfall to the front of the gate in front of the White House where we were arrested. You know, when they were putting the plastic handcuffs on our hands, the Washington, D.C. police, most of whom are in National Guard units and have been in Iraq and Afghanistan, were telling us, you know, you guys are right about this war. So did we stop the war? No. But the movement itself, it almost has a kind of religious quality. It's deeply empowering and deeply moving. And I think that what is a guarantor of despair and cynicism is to do nothing. And that if we, if we stand up the way they are standing up in Wisconsin, even if penultimately we don't win, we empower ourselves to keep going, and ultimately we keep alive the possibility for hope, real hope.
Chris Hedges, author of Death of a Liberal Class and War is the Force That Gives Us Meaning, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.
So that is the show for today, folks. Thanks for joining us. If you are a member or you're listening live, join me on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. Got a couple more stories we're going to go through. Some just sort of stunning examples of right-wing malfeasance, malevolence, and retardery. That's a word. All right, see you tomorrow, folks. Thanks for joining us. Hey, folks, as I always say, your membership is the only thing that will ensure we can keep doing this show. So please, if you can, join today at majority.fm. Not only will you support the show, you'll get an extra 50 minutes of the show every day, plus all sorts of other membership goodies. But if you can't become a member, you can still support the show in other ways by virtually doing nothing. Head to majority.fm, find the Majority FM Amazon.com graphic, click on it, bookmark it, buy goods from Amazon as you normally would, and you'll actually be redistributing wealth from a corporate behemoth to the independent media you listen to daily. That means me. It's simple and it really helps. So please, if you can do it, do it. And you can also donate your Twitter account for one retweet daily at majority.fm. Thanks.